Side 12. Christine. Continuing on page 453.
Not in any conscious way, no, LeBay said. Not any more than I am suggesting that he consciously murdered her. If you had known my brother, you would know how ridiculous it is to suspect him of witchcraft or sorcery or trafficking with demons. He believed in nothing beyond his own senses, except, I suppose, for his own will. I am suggesting that he might have had some intuition, or that he might have been directed to do what he did. My mother said he was a changeling.
And Veronica?
I don't know, he said. The police verdict was suicide, even though there was no note. It may well have been. But the poor woman had made some friends in town, and I have often wondered if perhaps she had hinted to some of them, as she had to Marcia, that Rita's death was not quite as she and Raleigh had reported it. I have wondered if Raleigh found out. If you tell Georgie, I'll kill you. There's no proof one way or the other, of course. But I've wondered why she would do it the way she did. And I've wondered how a woman who didn't know the slightest thing about cars would know enough to get the hose and attach it to the exhaust pipe and put it in through the window. I try not to wonder about those things. They keep me awake at night. I thought about what he had said, and about the things he hadn't said, the things he had left between the lines. Intuitive, he had said. So single-minded in his few simple purposes, he had said. Suppose Roland LeBay had understood, in some way he wouldn't even admit to himself, that he was investing his Plymouth with some supernatural power. And suppose he had only been waiting for the right inheritor to come along, and now... Does that answer your questions, Dennis?
I think it does, I said slowly.
What are you going to do?
I think you know that.
Destroy the car?
I'm going to try, I said, and then looked over at my crutches leaning against the wall, my goddamn crutches.
You may destroy your friend as well.
I may save him, I said. Quietly, George LeBay said,
I wonder if that is still possible.
47. The Betrayal. There was blood and glass all over, and there was nobody there but me. As the rain tumbled down hard and cold, I seen a young man lying by the side of the road. He cried, Mister, won't you help me, please? Bruce Springsteen. I kissed her. Her arms slipped around my neck. One of her cool hands pressed lightly against the back of my head. There was no more question for me about what was going on. And when she pulled slightly away from me, her eyes half closed, I could see there was no question for her either.
Dennis, she murmured, and I kissed her again. Our tongues touched gently. For a moment, her kiss intensified. I could feel the passion those high cheekbones hinted at. Then she gasped a little and drew back. That's enough, she said. We'll be arrested for indecent exposure or something.
It was January 18th. We were parked in the lot behind the local Kentucky Fried, the remains of a pretty decent chicken dinner spread around us. We were in my duster, and that alone was something of an occasion for me. It was my first time behind the wheel since the accident. Just that morning, the doctor had removed the huge cast on my left leg and replaced it with a brace. His warning to stay off it was stern, but I could tell he was feeling good about the way things were going for me. My recovery was about a month ahead of schedule. He put it down to superior technique, my mother to positive thinking and chicken soup, Coach Puffer to rose hips. Me, I thought Lee Cabot had a lot to do with it.
We have to talk, she said.
No, let's make out some more, I said.
Talk now, make out later.
Has he started again? She nodded. In the almost 2 weeks since my telephone conversation with LeBay, the first 2 weeks of winter term, Arnie had been working at making a rapprochement with Lee, working at it with an intensity that scared both of us. I had told her about my talk with George LeBay, but not as I've said about my terrible ride home on New Year's morning.
and made it as clear as I could that on no account should she simply cut him off. That would drive him into a fury, and these days, when Arnie was furious with someone, unpleasant things happened to them.
That makes it like cheating on him, she said.
I know, I said, more sharply than I had intended. I don't like it, but I don't want that car rolling again.
So?
And I shook my head. In truth, I was starting to feel like Prince Hamlet, delaying and delaying. I knew what had to be done, of course. Christine had to be destroyed. Lee and I had looked into ways of doing it. The first idea had been Lee's, Molotov's cocktails. We would, she said, fill some wine bottles with gasoline, take them to the Cunningham house in the early morning hours, light the wicks.
Wicks? What wicks?
I asked. Kotex ought to do just fine, she answered promptly, causing me to wonder again about her high-cheekboned forebears, and toss them in through Christine's windows.
What if the windows are rolled up and the doors are locked? I asked her. That's the way it's apt to be, you know.
She looked at me as if I was a total drip. Are you saying, she asked, that the idea of firebombing Arnie's car is okay, but you've got moral scruples about breaking some glass?
No, I said. But who's going to get close enough to her to break the glass with a hammer, Lee?
You?
She looked at me, biting at her soft lower lip. She said nothing.
The next idea had been mine. Dynamite.
Lee thought about it and shook her head.
I could get it without too much sweat, I think, I said. I still saw Brad Jeffries from time to time, and Brad still worked for Penn DOT, and Penn DOT had enough dynamite to put Three River Stadium on the moon. I thought that maybe I could borrow the right key without Brad knowing I had borrowed it. He had a way of getting tanked up when the Penguins were on the tube. Borrow the key to the explosive shed during the third period of one game, I thought, and return it to his ring in the third period of another. The chance that he would be wanting explosives in January, and thus realize his key was missing, was small indeed. It was a deception, another betrayal, but it was a way to end things.
No, she said.
Why not? To me, dynamite seemed to offer the kind of utter finality the situation demanded.
Because Arnie keeps it parked in his driveway now. Do you really want to send shrapnel flying all over a suburban neighborhood, risking a piece of flying glass cutting off some little kid's head?
I winced. I hadn't thought of that. But now that she mentioned it, the image seemed sharp and clear and hideous. And that got me thinking about other things. Lighting a bundle of dynamite with your cigarillo and then tossing it overhand at the object you wanted to destroy, that might look okay on the Saturday afternoon westerns they showed on Channel 2, but in real life there were blasting caps and contact points to deal with. Still, I held on to the idea as long as I could.
If we did it at night?
Still pretty dangerous, she said, and you know it too. It's all over your face.
A long, long pause.
What about the crusher at Darnell's? She asked finally.
Same basic objection as before, I said. Who gets to drive her down there? You, me, or Arnie?
And that was where matters still stood.
What was it today? I asked her.
He wanted me to go out with him tonight, she said, bowling this time. In previous days, it had been the movies, out for dinner, over to watch TV at his house, proposed study dates. Christine figured in all of them as the mode of transport. He's getting ugly about it, and I'm running out of excuses. If we're going to do something, we ought to do it soon. I nodded. Failure to find a satisfactory method was one thing. The other thing holding us back had been my leg. Now the cast was off, and although I was on stern doctor's orders to use my crutches, I had tested the left leg without them. There was some pain, but not as much as I had feared. Those things, yeah. But mostly there had been us, discovering each other. And although it's going to sound stinking, I guess I ought to add something else if this thing is going to stay straight, and I promised myself when I began to tell the tale that I'd stop if I found I couldn't get it straight or keep it straight. The spice of danger had added something to what I felt for her, and I think to what she felt for me. He was my best friend, but there was still a dirty, senseless attraction in the idea that we were seeing each other behind his back. I felt that each time I drew her into my arms, each time my hand slipped over the firm swelling of her breasts, the sneaking around. Can you tell me why that should have an attraction? But it did. For the first time in my life, I had fallen for a girl. I had slipped before, but this time I had taken the grand head-over-heels tumble, and I loved it. I loved her. That constant sense of betrayal, though, that was a snake-like thing, both a shame and a crazy sort of goad. We could tell each other, and we did, that we were keeping our mouths shut to protect our families and ourselves. That was true.
But it wasn't all, Lee, was it? No, it wasn't all. In one way, nothing worse could have happened. Love slows down reaction time. It mutes the sense of danger. My conversation with George LeBay was 12 long days in the past, and thinking about the things he had said, and worse, the things he had suggested, no longer raised the hair on the back of my neck. The same was true, or not true, of the few times I talked with Arnie or glimpsed him in the halls. In a strange way, we seemed to be back in September and October again, when we had grown apart simply because Arnie was so busy. When we did talk, he seemed pleasant enough, although the gray eyes behind his specs were cool. I waited for a wailing Regina or a distraught Michael to call me on the phone with the news that Arnie had finally stopped toying with them and had given up the idea of college in the fall for certain. That didn't happen. And it was from Motormouth himself, our guidance counselor, that I heard Arnie had taken home a lot of literature on the University of Pennsylvania, Drew University, and Penn State. Those were the schools Lee was most interested in. I knew it, and Arnie knew it, too. Two nights earlier, I had happened to overhear my mother and my sister Ellie in the kitchen. "Why doesn't Arnie ever come over anymore, Mom?" Ellie asked. "Did he and Dennis have a fight?" "No, honey," my mother answered. "I don't think so, but when friends get older, sometimes they grow apart." "That's never going to happen to me," Ellie said, with all the awesome conviction of the just-turned 15. I sat in the other room, wondering if maybe that was really all it was. Hallucination brought on by my long stay in the hospital, as LeBay had suggested, and a simple growing apart, a developing space between two childhood friends. I could see a certain logic to it, even down to my fixation on Christine, the wedge that had come between us. It ignored the hard facts, but it was comfortable. To believe such a thing would allow Lee and me to pursue our ordinary lives, to get involved in school activities, to do a little extra cramming for the scholastic achievement tests in March, and, of course, to jump into each other's arms as soon as her parents or mine left the room. To neck like what we were, which was a couple of horny teenagers totally infatuated with each other. Those things lulled me, lulled us both. We had been careful, as careful, in fact, as adulterers instead of a couple of kids. But today the cast had come off. Today I had been able to use the keys to my duster again instead of just looking at them. And on an impulse, I had called Lee up and asked her if she'd like to go out to the world-famous Colonel's with me for a little of his world-famous crunchy style. She had been delighted. So maybe you see how our attention waned, how we became the smallest bit indiscreet. We sat in the parking lot, the duster's engine running so we could have some heat, and we talked about putting an end to that old and infinitely clever she-monster, like a couple of children playing cowboys. Neither of us saw Christine when she pulled up behind us. "He's buckling down for a long siege, if that's what it takes," I said. "What? The colleges he applied to, hasn't it hit you yet?" "I guess not," she said, mystified. "They're the schools you're most interested in," I said patiently. She looked at me. I looked back, trying to smile, not making it. "All right," I said. "Let's go over it one more time. Molotov cocktails are out. Dynamite looks risky, but in a pinch..." Lee's harsh gasp stopped me right there. That, and the expression of startled horror on her face. She was staring out through the windshield, eyes wide, mouth open. I turned in that direction, and what I saw was so stunning that for a moment I was immobilized, too. Arnie was standing in front of my duster. He had parked directly behind us and gone in to get his chicken without realizing who it was. And why should he? It was nearly dark, and one splashed and muddy four-year-old duster looks pretty much like another. He had gone in, had gotten his chow, had come out again, and stared right in through the windshield at Lee and me, sitting close together, our arms around each other, looking deep into each other's eyes, as the poets say. Nothing but a coincidence, a grisly, hideous coincidence. Except that even now, a part of my mind is coldly convinced that it was Christine. That even at that turn, Christine led him there. There was a long, frozen moment. A little moan escaped Lee's throat. Arnie stood not quite halfway across the small parking lot, dressed in his high school jacket, faded jeans, boots. A plaid scarf was tied around his throat. The collar of his jacket was turned up, and its black wings framed a face that was slowly twisting from an expression of sick incredulity into a pallid grimace of hate. The red and white striped bag with the colonel's smiling face on it slipped out of one of his gloved hands and thumped onto the packed snow of the parking lot.
"Dennis," Lee whispered. "Dennis, oh my God."
He began to run. I thought he was coming to the car, probably to haul me out and work me over. I could see myself hopping feebly around on my not-so-good leg under the parking lot lights that had just come on while Arnie, whose life I had saved all those years going back to kindergarten, beat the living Jesus out of me. He ran, his mouth twisted down in a snarl I had seen before, but not on his face. It was LeBay's face now. He didn't stop at my car. Instead, he ran right past. I twisted around, and that was when I saw Christine. I got my door open and began to struggle out, grabbing onto the roof gutter for support. The cold numbed my fingers almost at once.
"Dennis, no!"
Lee cried. I got on my feet just as Arnie raked open Christine's door.
"Arnie!" I shouted. "Hey, man!"
His head jerked up. His eyes were wide and blank and glaring. A line of spittle was working its way down from one corner of his mouth. Christine's grill seemed to be snarling, too. He raised both fists and shook them at me.
"You shitter!"
His voice was high and cracked.
"Have her! You deserve her! She's shit! You're both shit! Have each other! You won't for long!"
People had come to the plate glass windows of the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the neighboring Kowloon Express to see what was going on.
"Arnie, let's talk, man."
He jumped in the car and slammed her door. Christine's engine screamed and her headlights came on, the glaring white eyes of my dream pinning me like a bug on a card. And over them, behind the glass, was Arnie's terrible face, the face of a devil sick of sin. That face, both hateful and haunted, has lived in my dreams ever since. Then the face was gone. It was replaced by a skull, a grinning death's head. Lee uttered a high, piercing scream. She had turned around to look, so I knew that it wasn't just my imagination. She had seen it, too. Christine roared forward, her rear tires spinning snow back. She didn't come for the duster, but for me. I think his intention was to grind me to jelly between his car and mine. It was only my bad left leg that saved me. It buckled and I fell back inside my duster, bumping my right hip on the wheel and honking the horn. A cold wave of wind buffeted my face. Christine's bright red flank passed within 3 feet of me. She roared down the takeout joint's in drive and shot on a JFK drive without slowing, rear-end fishtailing. Then she was gone, still accelerating. I looked at the snow and could see the fresh, zigzag treads of her tires. She had missed my open door by no more than 3 inches. Lee was crying. I pulled my left leg into the car with my hands, slammed the door, then held her. Her arms groped for me blindly and then grasped with panicky tightness.
It wasn't...
Shh, Lee, never mind. Don't think about it.
That wasn't Arnie driving that car. It was a dead person. It was a dead person.
It was LeBay, I said. And now that it had happened, I felt a kind of eerie calm instead of the trembly, close-call reaction I should have had. That and the guilt of finally being discovered with my best friend's girl. It was him, Lee. You just met Roland D. LeBay. She wept, crying out her fear and shock and horror, holding on to me. I was glad to have her. My left leg throbbed dully. I looked up into the rearview mirror at the empty slot where Christine had been. Now that it had happened, it seemed to me that any other conclusion would have been impossible. The peace of the last 2 weeks, the simple joy of having Lee on my side, all of that now seemed to be the unnatural thing, the false thing, as false as the phony war between Hitler's conquest of Poland and the Wehrmacht's rolling assault on France. And I began to see the end of things, how it would be. She looked up at me, her cheeks wet.
"What now, Dennis? What do we do now?"
"Now we end it."
"How? What do you mean?"
Speaking more to myself than to her, I said, "He needs an alibi. We have to be ready when he goes away. The garage, Darnell's. I'm going to trap it in there, try to kill it."
"Dennis, what are you talking about?"
"He'll leave town," I said. "Don't you see? All of the people Christine has killed, they make a ring around Arnie. He'll know that. He'll get Arnie out of town again."
"LeBay, you mean?"
I nodded, and Lee shuddered. "We have to kill it, you know that."
"But how? Please, Dennis, how are we going to do it?"
And at last, I had an idea. 48. Preparations. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. The Doors. I dropped Lee off at her house and told her to call me if she saw Christine cruising around. What are you going to do, come over here with a flamethrower? A bazooka, I said, and we both started to laugh hysterically. Nuke the 58! Nuke the 58! Lee yelled, and we got laughing again. But all the time we were laughing, we were scared half out of our minds, maybe more than half. And all the time we were laughing, I was sick over Arnie, both over what he had seen and what I had done. And I think Lee felt the same. It's just that sometimes you have to laugh, sometimes you just do. And when it comes, nothing can keep that laugh away. It just walks in and does its stuff. So what do I tell my folks? She asked me when we finally started to come down a little. I've got to tell them something, Dennis. I can't just let them risk being run down in the street. Nothing, I said. Tell them nothing at all. But for one thing, they wouldn't believe you. For another, nothing's going to happen as long as Arnie's in Libertyville. I'd stake my life on that. You are, dummy, she whispered. I know. My life, my mother's, my father's, my sister's. How will we know if he leaves? I'll take care of that. You're going to be sick tomorrow. You're not going to school.
I'm sick right now, she said in a low voice. Dennis, what's going to happen? What are you planning?
I'll call you later tonight, I said, and kissed her. Her lips were cold. When I got home, Elaine was struggling into her parka and muttering black imprecations at people who sent other people down to Tom's for milk and bread just when Dance Fever was coming on TV. She was prepared to be grumpy at me as well, but she cheered up when I offered to give her a lift down to the market and back. She also gave me a suspicious look, as if this unexpected kindness to the little sister might be the onset of some disease, herpes maybe. She asked me if I felt all right. I only smiled blandly and told her to hop in before I changed my mind, although by now my right leg was aching and my left was throbbing fiercely. I could talk on and on to Lee about how Christine wouldn't roll as long as Arnie was in Libertyville, and intellectually I knew that I was right, but it didn't change the instinctive rolling in my guts when I thought of Ellie walking the two blocks to Tom's and crossing the dark suburban side streets in her bright yellow parka. I kept seeing Christine parked down one of those streets, crouched in the dark like an old bitch hunting dog. When we got to Tom's, I gave her a buck. Get us each a yodel and a Coke, I said.
Dennis, are you feeling all right?
Yes, and if you put my change in that asteroids game, I'll break your arm. That seemed to set her mind at rest. She went in, and I sat slumped behind the wheel of my duster, thinking about what a terrible box we were in. We couldn't talk to anyone. That was the nightmare. That was where Christine was so strong. Was I going to grab my dad down in his toy shop and tell him that what Ellie called Arnie Cunningham's pukey old red car was now driving itself? Was I going to call the cops and tell them that a dead guy wanted to kill my girlfriend and myself? No. The only thing on our side, other than the fact that the car couldn't move until Arnie had an alibi, was the fact that it would want no witnesses. Moochie Welch, Don Vandenberg, and Will Darnell had been killed alone late at night. Buddy Repperton and his two friends had been killed out in the boonies. Elaine came back with a bag clutched to her budding bosom, got in, gave me my Coke and my yodel. Change, I said. You're a booger snot, she said, but put some 20-odd cents in my outstretched hand. I know, but I love you anyway, I said. I pushed her hood back, ruffled her hair, and then kissed her ear. She looked surprised and suspicious, and then she smiled. She wasn't such a bad sort, my sister Ellie. The thought of her being run down on the street simply because I fell in love with Lee Cabot after Arnie went mad and left her, I simply wasn't going to let that happen. At home, I worked my way upstairs after saying hi to my mom. She wanted to know how the leg was doing, and I told her it was in good shape. But when I got upstairs, I made the bathroom medicine cabinet my first stop. I swallowed a couple of aspirin for the sake of my legs, which were now singing Ave Maria. Then I went down to my folks' bedroom, where the upstairs phone is, and sat down in Mom's rocking chair with a sigh. I picked up the phone and made the first of my calls. "Dennis Gilder, scourge of the Turnpike Extension Project," Brad Jeffries said heartily. "Good to hear from you, kiddo. When you gonna come over and watch the Penguins with me again?" "I don't know," I said. "I get tired of watching handicapped people play hockey after a while. Now, if you got interested in a good team like the Flyers..." "Christ, have I got to listen to this from a kid that isn't even mine?" Brad asked. "The world really is going to hell, I guess." We chatted for a while longer, just kicking things back and forth. And then I told him why I had called. He laughed. "What the fuck, Danny? You going into business for yourself?" "You might say so," I thought of Christine, "for a limited time only." "Don't want to talk about it?"
Well, not just yet. Do you know someone who might have an item like that for rent? I tell you, Dennis, there's only one guy I know who might do business with you on anything like that. Johnny Pomberton. Lives out on the Ridge Road. He's got more rolling stock than Carter's got liver pills. Okay, I said. Thanks, Brad. How's Arnie? All right, I guess. I don't see as much of him as I used to. Funny guy, Dennis. I never in my wildest dreams thought he'd last out the summer the first time I set eyes on him, but he had one hell of a lot of determination. Yeah, I said, all of that and then some. Say hi to him when you see him. I'll do it, Brad. Stay loose. Can't live if you do anything else, Denny. Come on over some night and peel a few cans with me. I will. Good night. Night. I hung up and then hesitated over the phone for a minute or two, not really wanting to make this next call. But it had to be done. It was central to the whole sorry, stupid business. I picked the telephone up and dialed the Cunningham's number from memory. If Arnie answered, I would simply hang up without speaking. But my luck was in. It was Michael who answered. Hello? His voice sounded tired and a bit slurred. Michael, this is Dennis. Hey, hi. He sounded genuinely pleased. Is Arnie there? Upstairs. He came home from somewhere and went right to his room. He looks pretty thundery, but that's far from unusual these days. Want me to call him? No, I said. That's okay. It was really you I wanted to talk to anyhow. I need a favor. Well, sure. Name it. I realized what that slur in his voice was. Michael Cunningham was at least halfway snookered. You did us a hell of a favor, talking some sense to him about college. Michael, I don't think he listened to a thing I said. Well, something sure happened. He's applied to 3 schools just this month. Regina thinks you walk on water, Dennis. And just between me and thee, she's pretty ashamed of the way she treated you when Arnie first told us about his car. But you know Regina, she's never been able to say, I'm sorry. I knew that, all right. And what would Regina think, I wondered, if she knew that Arnie, or whatever controlled Arnie, didn't have any more interest in college than a hog has in mutual funds? That he was simply following Lee's tracks, hounding her, fixated on her. It was perversion on perversion. Libé, Lee, and Christine in some hideous ménage à trois. Listen, Michael, I said, I'd like you to call me if Arnie decides to go out of town for some reason, especially in the next day or two or over the weekend, day or night. I have to know if Arnie's going to leave Libertyville, and I have to know before he leaves. It's very important. Why? I'd just as soon not go into that. It's complicated, and it would sound crazy. There was a long, long silence. And when Arnie's dad spoke again, his voice was a near whisper. It's that goddamn car of his, isn't it? How much did he suspect? How much did he know? If he was like most people I knew, he probably suspected a little more drunk than sober. How much? Even now, I don't know for sure. But what I believe is that he suspected more than anyone, except maybe Will Darnell. Yeah, I said, it's the car. I knew it, he said dully. I knew. What's happening, Dennis? How is he doing it, do you know? Michael, I can't say any more. Will you tell me if he plans a trip tomorrow or the next day? Yes, he said, yes, all right. Thanks. Dennis, he said. Do you think I'll ever have my son back? He deserved the truth. That poor deviled man deserved the truth. I don't know, I said, and bit at my lower lip until it hurt. I think that it may have gone too far for that. Dennis, he almost wailed. What is it? Drugs? Some kind of drugs? I'll tell you when I can, I said. That's all I can promise you. I'm sorry. I'll tell you when I can. Johnny Pomberton was easier to talk to. He was a lively, garrulous man, and any fears I'd had that he wouldn't do business with a kid soon went by the board. I got the feeling that Johnny Pomberton would have done business with Satan freshly risen from hell with the smell of brimstone still on him, if he had good old legal tender. Sure, he kept saying. Sure, sure. You'd no more than started some proposition before Johnny Pomberton was agreeing with you. It was a little unnerving. I had a cover story, but I don't think he even listened to it. He simply quoted me a price, a very reasonable one, as it turned out. That sounds fine, I said. Sure, he agreed. What time you coming by? Well, how at 9:30 tomorrow? Sure, he said. See you then.
One other question, Mr. Pemberton.
Sure, and make it Johnny.
Okay, Johnny, then. What about automatic transmission?
Johnny Pemberton laughed heartily, so heartily that I held the phone away from my ear a bit, feeling glum. That laugh was answer enough.
On one of these babies, you've got to be kidding. Why? Can't you run a standard shift?
Yes, that's what I learned on, I said.
Sure, so you got no problems, right?
I guess not, I said, thinking of my left leg, which would be running the clutch, or trying to. Simply shifting it around a little tonight had made it ache like hell. I hoped that Arnie would wait a few days before taking his trip out of town, but somehow I didn't think that was in the cards. It would be tomorrow, over the weekend at the latest, and my left leg would simply have to bear up as best it could. Well, good night, Mr. Pemberton. I'll see you tomorrow.
Sure. Thanks for calling, kid. I got one all picked out in my mind for you. You'll like her, see if you don't. And if you don't start calling me Johnny, I'm going to double the price.
Sure, I said, and hung up on his laughter.
You'll like her. See if you don't. Her again.
I was becoming morbidly aware of that casual form of referral, and getting damned sick of it. Then I made my last preparatory call. There were 4 Sykeses in the phone book. I got the one I wanted on my second try. Jimmy himself answered the phone. I introduced myself as Arnie Cunningham's friend, and Jimmy's voice brightened. He liked Arnie, who hardly ever teased him and never punched on him, as Buddy Repperton had done when Buddy worked for Will. He wanted to know how Arnie was, and lying again, I told him Arnie was fine.
"Geez, that's good," he said. He really had his butt in a sling there for a while. I knew them fireworks and cigarettes was no good for him.
"It's Arnie I'm calling for," I said. "You remember when Will got arrested and they shut down the garage, Jimmy?"
"Sure do," Jimmy sighed. "Now poor old Will's dead, and I'm out of a job. My ma keeps saying I got to go to the vocational technical school, but I wouldn't be no good at that. I guess I'll go for being a janitor or something like that. My Uncle Fred's a janitor up to the college, and he says there's an opening because this other janitor, he disappeared, just took off or something, and..."
"Arnie says when they closed down the garage, he lost his whole socket wrench kit," I broke in. "It was up behind some of those old tires, you know, on the overhead racks. He put them up there so no one would rip him off."
"Still there?" Jimmy asked.
"I guess so."
"What a bummer."
"You know it. That set of bolt fuckers was worth $100.
"Holy crow. I bet they ain't there anymore anyway, though. I bet one of them cops got it."
"Arnie thinks they might still be there, but he's not supposed to go near the garage because of the trouble he's in." This was a lie, but I didn't think Jimmy would catch it, and he didn't. Putting one over on a fellow who was borderline retarded didn't add a thing to my self-esteem, however.
"Oh, shit. Well, listen, I'll go down and look for him. Yes, sir, tomorrow morning, first thing. I still got my keys."
I breathed a sigh of relief. It wasn't Arnie's mythical set of socket wrenches that I wanted. I wanted Jimmy's keys. "I'd like to get them, Jimmy, that's the thing, as a surprise. And I know right where he put them. You might hunt around all day and still not find them."
"Oh, yeah, for sure. I was never no good at finding things. That's what Will said. He always said I couldn't find my own behind with both hands and a flashlight."
"Ah, man, he was just putting you down. But really, I'd like to do it."
"Well, sure.
I thought I'd come by tomorrow and borrow your keys. I could get that set of wrenches and have your keys back to you before dark."
"Gee, I don't know. Will said to never loan out my keys."
"Sure, before, but the place is empty now except for Arnie's tools and a bunch of junk out back. The estate will be putting it up for sale pretty soon. Contents complete, and if I take them after that, it would be like stealing."
"Oh. Well, I guess it'd be okay if you bring my keys back."
And then he said an absurdly touching thing.
"See, they're all I got to remember Will by."
"It's a promise."
"Okay," he said. "If it's for Arnie, I guess it's okay."
Just before bed, now downstairs, I made one final call to a very sleepy-sounding Lee.
One of these next few nights we're going to end it. You game?
Yes, she said, I am. I think I am.
What have you got planned, Dennis?
So I told her, going through it step by step, half expecting her to poke a dozen holes in my idea. But when I was done, she simply said, what if it doesn't work?
You make the honor roll. I don't think you need me to draw you a picture.
No, she said, I guess not.
I'd keep you out of it if I could, I said. But LeBay is going to suspect a trap, so the bait has to be good.
I wouldn't let you leave me out of it, she said. Her voice was steady. This is my business, too. I loved him. I really did. And once you start loving someone, I don't think you ever really get over it completely, do you, Dennis?
I thought of the years, the summers of reading and swimming and playing games, Monopoly, Scrabble, Chinese checkers, the ant farms, the times I had kept him from getting killed in all the ways kids like to kill the outsider, the one who's a little bit strange, a little bit off the beat. There had been times when I had gotten pretty fucking sick of keeping him from getting killed. Times when I had wondered if my life wouldn't be easier, better, if I simply let Arnie go, let him drown. But it wouldn't have been better. I had needed Arnie to make me better, and he had. We had traded fair all the way down the line. And, oh shit, this was very bitter, very fucking bitter indeed.
No, I said. And I suddenly had to put my hand over my eyes. I don't think you ever do. I loved him, too. And maybe it isn't too late for him, even now.
That's what I would have prayed. Dear God, let me keep Arnie from getting killed just one more time, just this one last time.
It's not him I hate, she said, her voice low. It's that man LeBay. Did we really see that thing this afternoon, Dennis, in the car?
Yes, I said, I think we did.
Him and that bitch Christine, she said.
Will it be soon?
Soon, yeah, I think so. All right. I love you, Dennis.
I love you, too.
As it turned out, it ended the next day. Friday, the 19th of January. 49. Arnie. I was cruising in my Stingray late one night when an XKE pulled up on the right. He rolled down the window of his shiny new Jag and challenged me then and there to a drag. I said, you're on, buddy. My mill's running fine. Let's come off the line at Sunset and Vine, but I'll go you one better if you got the nerve. Let's race all the way to Dead Man's Curve. Jan and Dean. I began that long, terrible day by driving over to Jimmy Sykes's house in my duster. I'd expected there might be some trouble from Jimmy's mother. But that turned out to be okay. She was, if anything, mentally slower than her son. She invited me in for bacon and eggs. I declined. My stomach was tied in miserable knots, and clucked over my crutches while Jimmy hunted around in his room for his key ring. I made small talk with Mrs. Sykes, who was roughly the size of Mount Etna, while time passed and a dismal certainty rose inside me. Jimmy had lost his keys somewhere, and the whole thing was off the rails before it could really begin. He came back, shaking his head. Can't find them, he said. Geez, I guess I must have lost them somewhere. What a bummer.
And Mrs. Sykes, nearly 300 pounds on the hoof in a faded house dress and her hair up in puffy pink rollers, said with blessed practicality,
did you look in your pockets, Jim?
A startled expression crossed Jimmy's face. He rammed a hand into the pocket of his green chino work pants. Then, with a shame-faced grin, he pulled out a bunch of keys. They were on one of the key rings they sell at the novelty shop in the Monroeville Mall, a large rubber fried egg. The egg was dark with grease.
There you are, you little suckers, he said. You watch your language, young man, Mrs. Sykes said. Just show Dennis which key it is that opens the door, and keep your dirty language in your head.
Jimmy ended up handing 3 Schlage keys over to me, because they weren't labeled and he couldn't tell which was which. One of them opened the main overhead door, one opened the back overhead door, the one which gave on the long lot of junked cars, and one opened the door to Will's office. Thanks, I said. I'll have these back to you just as soon as I can, Jimmy.
Great, Jimmy said. Say hello to Arnie when you see him.
You bet, I said.
You sure you don't want some bacon and eggs, Dennis?
Mrs. Sykes asked.
There's plenty.
Thanks, I said, but I really ought to get going.
It was 8:15. School started at 9. Arnie usually pulled in around 8:45, Leah told me. I just had time. I got my crutches under me and got to my feet.
"Help him out, Jim," Mrs. Sykes commanded. "Don't just stand there."
I started to protest, and she waved me away.
"Wouldn't want you to fall on your can getting back to your car, Dennis. Might break your leg all over again."
She laughed uproariously at this, and Jimmy, the soul of obedience, practically carried me back to my duster. The sky that day was a scummy, frowsy gray, and the radio was predicting more snow by late afternoon. I drove across town to Libertyville High, took the driveway which led to the student parking lot, and parked in the front row. I didn't need Lee to tell me that Arnie usually parked in the back row. I had to see him, had to strew the bait in front of his nose. But I wanted him as far from Christine as possible when I did it. Away from the car, Libet's hold seemed weaker. I sat with the key turned over to accessory for the radio and looked at the football field. It seemed impossible that I had ever traded sandwiches with Arnie on those snow-covered bleachers. Impossible to believe that I had run and cavorted on that field myself, dressed up in padding, helmet, and tight pants, stupidly convinced of my own physical invulnerability, perhaps even of my own immortality. I didn't feel that way anymore, if I ever had. Students were coming in, parking their cars, and heading for the building, chattering and laughing and horsing around. I slouched lower in my seat, not wanting to be recognized. A bus pulled up at the doors in the main turnaround and disgorged a load of kids. A small cluster of shivering boys and girls gathered out in the smoking area where Buddy had taken Arnie on that day last fall. That day also seemed impossibly distant now. My heart was thumping in my chest, and I was miserably tense. A craven part of me hoped that Arnie simply wouldn't show up. And then I saw the familiar white-over-red shape of Christine turn in from School Street and cruise up the student drive, moving at a steady 20, blowing a little plume of white exhaust from her tailpipe. Arnie was behind the wheel wearing a school jacket. He didn't look at me. He simply drove to his accustomed place at the back of the lot and parked. "Just stay slouched down and he won't even see you," that craven, traitorous part of my mind whispered. "He'll walk right by you like all the rest of them." Instead, I opened my door and fumbled my crutches outside. Leaning my weight on them, I yanked myself out and stood there on the packed snow of the parking lot, feeling a little bit like Fred McMurray in that old picture, Double Indemnity. From the school came the burring of the first bell, made faint and unimportant by distance. Arnie was later than he had been in the old days. My mother had said that Arnie was almost disgustingly punctual. Maybe LeBay hadn't been. He came toward me, books under his arm, head down, twisting in and out between the cars. He walked behind a van, passing out of my sight temporarily, and then came back into view. He looked up then, directly into my eyes. His own eyes widened, and he made an automatic half-turn back toward Christine. "Feel kind of naked when you're not behind the wheel?" I asked. He looked back at me. His lips drew slightly downward as if he had tasted something of unpleasant flavor. "How's your cunt, Dennis?" he asked. George LeBay hadn't said, but he had at least hinted that his brother was extraordinarily good at getting through to people, finding their soft spots. I took 2 shuffling steps forward on my crutches while he stood there, smiling with the corners of his mouth down. "How did you like it when Repperton called you cuntface?" I asked him. "Did you like it so well you want to turn it around and use it on somebody else?" Part of him seemed to flinch at that, something that was maybe only in his eyes, but the contemptuous, watchful smile remained on his lips. It was cold out. I hadn't put on my gloves, and my hands on the crossbars of the crutches were getting numb. Our breath made little plumes. "Well, what about in the 5th grade when Tommy Deckinger used to call you fart breath?" I asked, my voice rising. Getting angry at him hadn't been part of the game plan, but now it was here, shaking inside me. "Did you like that? And do you remember when Lad Smythe was a patrol boy and he pushed you down in the street and I pulled his hat off and stuffed it down his pants? Where you been, Arnie? This guy LeBay is a Johnny-come-lately. Me, I was here all along." That flinch again. This time he half turned away, the smile faltering, his eyes searching for Christine the way your eyes might search for a loved one in a crowded terminal or bus station, or the way a junkie might look for his pusher. "You need her that bad?" I asked. "Man, you're hooked right through the fucking bag, aren't you?" "I don't know what you're talking about," he said hoarsely. "You stole my girl. Nothing is going to change that. You went behind my back. You cheated. You're just a shitter like all the rest of them." He was looking at me now, his eyes wide and hurt and blazing with anger. "I thought I could trust you, and you turned out to be worse than Repperton or any of them.
He took a step toward me and cried out in a perfect fury of loss, "You stole her, you shitter!" I lurched forward another step on my crutches. One of them slid a little bit in the packed snow underfoot. We were like two reluctant gunslingers approaching each other. "You can't steal what's been given away," I said.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about the night she choked in your car, the night Christine tried to kill her. You told her you didn't need her. You told her to fuck off."
"I never did. That's a lie. That's a goddamn lie."
"Who am I talking to?" I asked.
"Never mind."
His gray eyes were huge behind his spectacles.
"Never mind who the fuck you're talking to. That's nothing but a dirty lie. No more than I'd expect from that stinking bitch."
Another step closer. His pale face was marked with flaring red patches of color. "When you write your name, it doesn't look like your signature anymore, Arnie."
"You shut up, Dennis."
"Your father says it's like having a stranger in the house."
"I'm warning you, man."
"Why bother?" I asked brutally. "I know what's going to happen. So does Lee. The same thing that happened to Buddy Repperton and Will Darnell and all the others, because you're not Arnie at all anymore. Are you in there, LeBay? Come on out and let me see you. I've seen you before. I saw you on New Year's Eve. I saw you yesterday at the chicken place. I know you're in there. Why don't you stop fucking around and come out?"
And he did, but in Arnie's face this time.
And that was more terrible than all the skulls and skeletons and comic book horrors ever thought of. Arnie's face changed. A sneer bloomed on his lips like a rancid rose. And I saw him, as he must have been back when the world was young and a car was all a young man needed to have. Everything else would just automatically follow. I saw George LeBay's big brother. I only remember one thing about him. But I remember that one thing very well, his anger. He was always angry. He came toward me, closing the distance between where he had been and where I stood propped on my crutches. His eyes were filmy and beyond all reach. That sneer was stamped on his face like the mark of a branding iron. I had time to think of the scar on George LeBay's forearm, skidding from his elbow to his wrist. He pushed me, and then he came back and threw me. I could hear that 14-year-old LeBay shouting, "You stay out of my way from now on, you goddamn snot-nose. Stay out of my way, you hear?" It was LeBay I was facing now, and he was not a man who took losing easily. Check that. He didn't take losing at all. "Fight him, Arnie," I said. "He's had his own way too long. Fight him, kill him, make him stay d—" He swung his foot and kicked my right crutch out from under me. I struggled to stay up, tottered, almost made it, and then he kicked the left crutch away. I fell down on the cold, packed snow. He took another step and stood above me, his face hard and alien.
"You got it coming, and you're going to get it," he said remotely.
"Yeah, right," I gasped. "You remember the ant farms, Arnie? Are you in there someplace? This dirty sucker never had a fucking ant farm in his life. He never had a friend in his life." And suddenly, the calm hardness broke. His face roiled. I don't know how else to describe it. LeBay was there, furious at having to put down a kind of internal mutiny. Then Arnie was there, drawn, tired, ashamed, but most of all desperately unhappy. Then LeBay again, and his foot drew back to kick me as I lay on the snow, groping for my crutches and feeling helpless and useless and dumb. Then it was Arnie again, my friend Arnie, brushing his hair back off his forehead in that familiar, distracted gesture. It was Arnie saying, "Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." "It's too late for sorry, man," I said. I got one crutch and then the other. I pulled myself up little by little, slipping twice before I could get the crutches under me again. Now my hands felt like pieces of furniture. Arnie made no move to help me. He stood with his back against the van, his eyes wide and shocked.
"Dennis, I can't help it," he whispered.
"Sometimes I feel like I'm not even here anymore.
Help me, Dennis. Help me."
"Is LeBay there?" I asked him.
"He's always here," Arnie groaned.
"Oh, God, always, except..." "The car?"
"When Christine...
when she goes, then he's with her.
That's the only time he's...
Arnie fell silent. His head slipped over to one side. His chin rolled on his chest in a boneless pivot. His hair dangled toward the snow. Spit ran out of his mouth and splattered on his boots. And then he began to scream thinly and beat his gloved fists on the van behind him.
"Go away! Go away! Go away!"
Then nothing for maybe 5 seconds, nothing except the shuddering of his body, as if a basket of snakes had been dumped inside his clothes, nothing except that slow, horrible roll of his chin on his chest. I thought maybe he was winning, that he was beating the dirty old son of a bitch. But when he looked up, Arnie was gone. LeBay was there.
"It's all going to happen just like he said," LeBay told me.
Let it go, boy. Maybe I won't drive over you. Come on over to Darnell's tonight, I said. My voice was harsh, my throat as dry as sand. We'll play. I'll bring Lee. You bring Christine. I'll pick my own time and place, LeBay said, and grinned with Arnie's mouth, showing Arnie's teeth, which were young and strong, a mouth still years from the indignity of dentures. You won't know when or where, but you'll know when the time comes. Think again, I said, almost casually. Come to Darnell's tonight, or she and I start talking tomorrow. He laughed, an ugly, contemptuous sound. And where will that get you, the asylum over at Reed City? Oh, we won't be taken seriously at first, I said. I give you that. But that stuff about how they put you in the loony bin as soon as you start talking about ghosts and demons? LeBay. Maybe in your day, before Flying Saucers and The Exorcist and that house in Amityville, these days a hell of a lot of people believe in that stuff. He was still grinning, but his eyes looked at me with narrow suspicion. That and something else. I thought that something else was the first sparkle of fear. And what you don't seem to realize is how many people know something is wrong. His grin faltered. Of course, he must have realized that and been worried about it. But maybe killing gets to be a fever. Maybe after a while you are simply unable to stop and count the cost. Whatever weird, filthy kind of life you still have is all wrapped up in that car, I said. You knew it, and you planned to use Arnie from the very beginning, except that planned is the wrong word because you never really planned anything, did you? You just followed your intuitions. He made a snarling sound and turned to go. You really want to think about it, I called after him. Arnie's father knows something is rotten. So does mine. I think there must be some police somewhere who'd be willing to listen to anything about how their friend Junkins died. And it all comes back to Christine, Christine, Christine. Sooner or later, someone's going to run her through the crusher in back of Darnell's just on general principles. He had turned back and was looking at me with a bright mixture of hate and fear in his eyes. We'll keep talking. And a lot of people will laugh at us, I don't doubt it. But I've got two pieces of cast with Arnie's signature on them. Only one of them isn't his. It's yours. I'll take them to the state cops and keep pestering them until they have a handwriting specialist confirm that. People are going to start watching Arnie. People are going to start watching Christine, too. You get the picture? Sonny, you don't worry me one fucking bit. But his eyes said something different. I was getting to him, all right. It's going to happen, I said. People are only rational on the surface. They still toss salt over their left shoulder if they spill the shaker. They don't walk under ladders. They believe in survival after death. And sooner or later, probably sooner, with Lee and me shooting off our mouths, someone is going to turn that car of yours into a sardine can. And I'm willing to bet that when it goes, you'll go with it. Don't you just wish, he sneered. We'll be at Darnell's tonight, I said. If you're good, you can get rid of both of us. That won't end it either, but it might give you some breathing space, time enough to get out of town. But I don't think you're good enough, chum. It's gone on too long. We're getting rid of you. I crutched back to my duster and got in. I used the crutches more clumsily than I had to, tried to make myself look more incapacitated than I really was. I had rocked him by mentioning the signatures. It was time to leave before I overplayed my hand. But there was one more thing. One thing guaranteed to drive LeBay into a frenzy. I pulled my left leg in with my hands, slammed the door, and leaned out. I looked into his eyes and smiled. She's great in bed, I said. Too bad you'll never know. With a furious roar, he charged at me. I rolled up the window and slapped down the door lock. Then, leisurely, I started the engine while he slammed his gloved fists on the glass. His face was snarling, terrible. There was no Arnie in it now, no Arnie at all. My friend was gone. I felt a dark sorrow that was deeper than tears or fear. But I kept that slow, insulting, dirty grin on my face. Then, slowly, I raised my middle finger to the glass. Fuck you, LeBay, I said, and then pulled out, leaving him to stand there in the lot, shaking with that simple, unswerving fury his brother had told me of. It was that, more than anything else, that I was counting on to bring him tonight. We'd see. 50. Petunia. Something warm was running in my eyes, but I found my baby somehow that night. I held her tight. I kissed her our last kiss. J. Frank Wilson and the Cavaliers. I drove about 4 blocks before the reaction set in, and then I had to pull over. I had the shakes, bad. Not even the heater, turned up to full, could kill them.
My breath came in harsh little gasps. I clutched myself to keep warm, but it seemed that I would never be warm again, never. That face, that horrible face, and Arnie buried somewhere inside. "He's always here," Arnie had said. "Always, except when..." What? When Christine rolled by herself, of course. LeBay couldn't be both places at the same time. That was beyond even his powers. At last, I was able to drive on again. And I wasn't even aware that I had been crying until I looked in the rearview mirror and saw the wet circles under my eyes. It was 10:15 by the time I made it out to Johnny Pomberton's place. He was a tall, broad-shouldered man wearing green gum-rubber boots and a heavy red-and-black checked hunting jacket. An old hat with a grease-darkened bill was tilted up on his balding head as he studied the gray sky.
"More snow coming, the radio says. Didn't know if you'd really be out, boy, but I brung her around for you just in case. What do you think of her?"
I got my crutches under me again and got out of my car. Road salt gritted under the crutches' rubber tips, but the going felt safe. Standing in front of Johnny Pomberton's woodpile was one of the strangest-looking vehicles I've ever seen in my life. A faint, pungent odor, not exactly pleasant, drifted over from it to where we stood. At one time, far back in its career, it had been a GM product, or so the logo on its gigantic snout advertised. Now it was a little bit of everything. One thing it surely was, and that was big. The top of its grill would have been head high on a tall man. Behind and over it, the cab loomed like a big square helmet. Behind that, supported by two sets of double wheels on each side, was a long tubular body, like the body of a gasoline tanker truck. Except that I never saw a tanker truck before this one that was painted bright pink. The word Petunia was written across the side in Gothic letters 2 feet high. "I don't know what to think of her," I said. "What is she?" Pomberton poked a Camel cigarette into his mouth and lit it with a quick flick of his horny thumbnail on the tip of a wooden match.
"Cockasucker," he said.
"What?" He grinned.
20,000-gallon capacity," he said. "She's a corker, is Petunia."
"I don't get you." But I was starting to. There was an absurd, grisly irony to it that Arnie, the old Arnie, would have appreciated. I'd asked Pomberton over the phone if he had a big, heavy truck to rent. And this was the biggest one currently in his yard. All four of his dump trucks were working, two in Libertyville and two others in Philly Hill. He'd had a grader, he explained to me, but it had had a nervous bust down just after Christmas. He said he was having a devilish job keeping his trucks rolling since Darnell's garage shut down. Petunia was essentially a tanker, no more and no less. Her job was pumping out septic systems. "How much does she weigh?" I asked Pomberton. He flicked away his cigarette.
"Dry or loaded with shit?"
I gulped. "Which is it now?" He threw his head back and laughed.
"Do you think I'd rent her a ludded truck?"
He pronounced it ludded truck.
No, she's dry. Dry as a bone and all hosed out. Sure she is. Still a little fragrant, though, ain't she?"
I sniffed. She was fragrant, all right. "It could be a lot worse," I said, "I guess."
"Sure," Pomberton said. "You bet. Old Petunia's original pedigree was lost long ago, but what's on her current registration is 18,000 pounds GVW.
"What's that?"
"A gross vehicle weight," he said. "If they pull you over on the interstate and you weigh more than 18,000, the ICC gets upset. Dry, she'd probably goes around, I don't know, 8,000-9,000 pounds. She's got a 5-speed tranny with a 2-speed differential, giving you 10 forward speeds all told, if you can run a clutch."
He cast a dubious eye up and down my crutches and lit another cigarette.
"Can you run a clutch?"
"Sure," I said with a straight face, "if it isn't really stiff." But for how long, that was the question.
"Well, it's your business, and I won't mess into it."
He looked at me brightly.
"I give you 10% discount for cash, on account of I don't usually report cash transactions to my favorite uncle."
I checked my wallet and found 420s and 410s. "How much did you say for one day?"
"That is $90, son."
I gave it to him. I had been prepared to pay 120.
"What are you going to do with your duster there?"
It hadn't even crossed my mind until just now. "Could I leave it here just for today?"
"Sure," Pomberton said. "You can leave it here all week. I don't give a shit. Just put it around the back and leave the keys in it in case I have to move it."
I drove around the back, where there was a wilderness of cannibalized truck parts poking out of the deep snow, like bones from white sand.
It took me nearly 10 minutes to work my way back around on my crutches. I could have done it faster if I'd used my left leg a bit, but I wouldn't do that. I was saving it for Petunia's clutch. I approached Petunia, feeling dread gather in my stomach like a small black cloud. I had no doubt it would stop Christine if she really showed up at Darnell's garage tonight, and if I could drive the damn truck. I'd never driven anything that big in my life, although the summer before I'd gotten some hours in on a bulldozer, and Brad Jeffries had let me try the payloader a couple of times after knocking off for the day. Pomberton stood there in his checked jacket, hands stuffed deep into the pockets of his work pants, watching me with wise eyes. I got over to the driver's side, grabbed the door handle, and slipped a little. He took a step or two toward me. I can make it.
Sure,
he said. I jammed the crutch into my armpit again, my breath frosting out in quick little gasps, and pulled the door open. Holding onto the door's inside handle with my left hand, and balancing on my right leg like a stork, I threw my crutches into the cab and then followed them. The keys were in the ignition, the shift pattern printed on the stick. I slammed the door, pushed the clutch down with my left leg, not much pain, so far so good, and started Petunia up. Her engine sounded like a full field of stalkers at Philly Plains. Pomberton strolled over.
Little noisy, ain't she?
He yelled.
Sure,
I screamed back.
You know, he bellowed, I'd doubt like hell if you got an eye on your license, boy.
An eye on your license meant that the state had tested you on the big trucks. I had an A for motorcycles, much to my mother's horror, but no eye. I grinned down at him.
You never checked because I looked trustworthy.
He smiled back.
Sure.
I revved the engine a little. Petunia blew off two brisk backfires that were almost as loud as mortar blasts.
You mind if I ask what you want that truck for? None of my business, I know.
Just what it was meant for, I said.
Begging your pardon? I want to get rid of some shit, I said.
I had something of a scare going downhill from Pomberton's place. Even dry and empty, that baby really got rolling. I seemed incredibly high up, able to look down on the roofs of the cars I passed. Driving through downtown Libertyville, I felt as conspicuous as a baby whale in a goldfish pond. It didn't help any that Pomberton's septic pumper was painted that bright pink color. I got some amused glances. My left leg had begun to ache a little, but running through Petunia's unfamiliar shift pattern in the stop-and-go downtown traffic kept my mind off it. A more surprising ache was developing in my shoulders and across my chest. It came from simply piloting Petunia through traffic. The truck was not equipped with power steering, and that wheel really turned hard. I turned off Main onto Walnut, and then into the parking lot behind the Western Auto. I got carefully down from Petunia's cab, slammed her door. My nose had already become used to the faint odor she gave off. Set my crutches under me and went in the back entrance. I got the three garage keys off Jimmy's ring and took them over to the key-making department. For $180, I got two copies of each. I put the new keys in one pocket, Jimmy's ring with his original keys reattached in the other. I went out the front door, onto Main Street, and down to the Libertyville Lunch, where there was a pay telephone. Overhead, the sky was grayer and more lowering than ever. Pomberton was right. There would be snow. Inside, I ordered a coffee and Danish and got change for the telephone booth. I went inside, closed the door clumsily behind me, and called Lee. She answered on the first ring.
Dennis, where are you?
The Libertyville Lunch. Are you alone?
Yes, Dad's at work and Mom went grocery shopping. Dennis, I almost told her everything. I started thinking about her parking at the A&P and crossing the parking lot, and I don't know. What you said about Arnie leaving town didn't seem to matter. It still made sense, but it didn't seem to matter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I said, thinking about giving Ellie a lift down to Tom's the night before, even though my leg was aching like hell by then. I know exactly what you mean.
Dennis, it can't go on like this. I'll go crazy. Are we still going to try your idea?
Yes, I said. Leave your mom a note, Lee. Tell her you have to be gone for a little while. Don't say any more than that. When you're not home for supper, your folks will probably call mine. Maybe they'll decide we ran off and eloped.
Maybe that's not such a bad idea, she said,
and laughed in a way that gave me prickles. I'll see you.
Hey, one other thing. Is there any painkiller in your house, Darvon, anything like that? There's some Darvon from the time Dad threw his back out, she said. Is it your leg, Dennis? It hurts a little. How much is a little? It's really okay. No BS? No BS, and after tonight I'll give it a nice long rest, okay? Okay. Get here as quick as you can. She came in as I was ordering a second cup of coffee, wearing a fur-fringed parka and a pair of faded jeans. The jeans were tucked into battered fry boots. She managed to look both sexy and practical, heads turned. Looking good, I said, and kissed her temple. She passed me a bottle of gray and pink gel capsules. You don't look so hot, though, Dennis. Here. The waitress, a woman of about 50 with iron gray hair, came over with my coffee. The cup sat placidly, an island in a small brown pond in the saucer. Why aren't you kids in school? She asked. Special dispensation, I said gravely. She stared at me. Coffee, please, Lee said, pulling off her gloves. As the waitress went back behind the counter with an audible sniff, she leaned toward me and said, It would be pretty funny if we got picked up by the truant officer, wouldn't it? Hilarious, I said, thinking that, in spite of the radiance the cold had given her, Lee really wasn't looking all that good. I didn't think either of us really would be until this thing was over. There were small strain lines around her eyes, as if she had slept poorly the night before. So what do? We get rid of it, I said. Wait until you see your chariot, madam. My God, Lee said, staring at Petunia's hot pink magnificence. It hulked silently in the Western Auto parking lot, dwarfing a Chevy van on one side and a Volkswagen on the other. What is it? Cock-a-sucker, I said, with a straight face. She looked at me, puzzled, and then she burst into hysterical gales of laughter. I wasn't sorry to see it happen. When I had told her about my confrontation with Arnie in the student parking lot that morning, those strain lines on her face had grown deeper and deeper, her lips whitening as they pressed together. I know that it looks sort of ridiculous, I said now. That's putting it mildly, she replied, still giggling and hiccuping. But it'll do the job, if anything will. Yes, yes, I suppose it should, and it's not exactly unfitting, is it? I nodded. I had that thought. Well, let's get in, she said. I'm cold. She climbed up into the cab ahead of me, her nose wrinkling. Ag, she said. I smiled. You get used to it. I handed her my crutches and climbed laboriously up behind the wheel. The pain in my left leg had subsided from a series of sharp clawings to a dull throb again. I had taken two Darvon back in the restaurant. Dennis, is your leg going to be all right? It'll have to be, I said, and slammed the door. 51. Christine. As I said to my friend, because I'm always talking, John, I said, which was not his name, the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it? Or else shall we, and why not, buy a goddamn big car? Drive, he said. For Christ's sake, look out where you're going. Robert Creeley. It was 11:30 or so when we pulled out of the Western Auto parking lot. The first spats of snow were coming down. I drove across town to the Sykes' house, shifting more easily now as the Darvon took hold. The house was dark and locked. Mrs. Sykes may be at work, Jimmy may be off collecting his unemployment or something. Lee found a crumpled-up envelope in her handbag, scratched off her address, and wrote Jimmy Sykes across the front in her slanting, pretty hand. She put Jimmy's key ring into the envelope, folded in the flap, and slipped it through the letter slot in the front door. While she did that, I let Petunia idle in neutral, resting my leg. What now? She asked, climbing back into the cab. Another phone call, I said. Out near the intersection of JFK Drive and Crescent Avenue, I found a telephone booth. I got carefully out of the truck, holding on until Lee handed down my crutches. Then I made my way carefully through the thickening snow to the booth. Seen through the dirty phone booth glass and the swirling snow, Petunia looked like some strange pink dinosaur. I called Horlicks University and went through the switchboard to get Michael's office. Arnie had told me once that his dad was a real office drone, always brown bagging it at lunch and staying in. Now, as the phone was picked up on the second ring, I blessed him for it. Dennis, I tried to reach you at home. Your mom said, Where's he going? My stomach was cold. It wasn't until then, at that exact moment, that all of it began to seem completely real to me, and I began to think that this crazy confrontation was going to come off. How did you know he was going? You've got to tell me. I don't have time for questions, and I couldn't answer them anyway. Where is he going? Slowly, he said. He and Regina are going to Penn State this afternoon, right after school. Arnie called her this morning and asked her if she'd go with him. He said... He paused, thinking. He said he felt as if he'd suddenly come to his senses. He said it just sort of hit him as he was going to school this morning that if he didn't do something definite about college, it might slip away from him. He told her he'd decided Penn State was the best bet, and asked her if she'd like to go up with him and talk to the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and to some of the people in the history and philosophy departments. The booth was cold. My hands were starting to go numb. Lee was high up in Petunia's wheelhouse, watching me anxiously. How well you arranged things, Arnie, I thought. Still the chess player. He was manipulating his mother, putting her on strings and making her dance. I felt some pity for her, but not as much as I might have felt. How many times had Regina herself been the manipulator, dancing others across her stage like so many Punch and Judys? Now, while she was half distracted with fear and shame, Libé had dangled in front of her eyes the one thing absolutely guaranteed to make her come running, the possibility that things might just be returning to normal. And did all that ring true to you? I asked Michael. Of course not, he burst out. It wouldn't have rung true to her if she was thinking straight. With college admissions what they are today, Penn State would enroll him in July if he had the money for tuition and the College Board scores, and Arnie has both. He talked as if this were the 50s instead of the 70s. When are they leaving? She's going to meet him at the high school after period 6. That's what she said when she called me. He's getting a dismissal slip. That meant they would be leaving Libertyville in less than an hour and a half. So I asked the last question, even though I already knew the answer. They're not taking Christine, are they? No, they're going in the station wagon. She was delirious with joy, Dennis. Delirious. That business of getting her to go with him to Penn State, that was inspired. Wild horses wouldn't have kept Regina from a chance like that. Dennis, what's going on? Please. Tomorrow, I said. That's a promise, firm. Meantime, you've got to do something for me. It could be a matter of life and death for my family and for Lee Cabot's family. You... Oh, my God, he said hoarsely. He spoke in the voice of a man for whom a great light has just dawned. He's been gone every time, except when the Welch boy was killed, and that time he was... Regina saw him asleep, and I'm sure she wasn't lying about that. Dennis, who's driving that car? Who's using Christine to kill people when Arnie isn't here? I almost told him, but it was cold in the telephone booth, and my leg was starting to ache again, and that answer would have led to other questions, dozens of them. And even then, the only final result might be a flat refusal to believe. Michael, listen, I said, speaking with all the deliberateness I could summon. For one weird moment, I felt like Mr. Rogers on TV. A big car from the 1950s is coming to eat you up, boys and girls. Can you say Christine? I knew you could. You've got to call my father and Lee's father. Have both families get together at Lee's house. I was thinking of brick, good solid brick. I think maybe you ought to go too, Michael. All of you stay together until Lee and I get there or until I call. But you tell them, for Lee and me, they're not to go outside after, I calculated, if Arnie and Regina left the high school at 2, how long before his alibi would be cast iron watertight? After 4 o'clock this afternoon. After 4, none of you go out on the street, any street, under no circumstances. Dennis, I can't just... You have to, I said. You'll be able to convince my old man, and between the two of you, you should be able to convince Mr. and Mrs. Cabot. And stay away from Christine yourself, Michael. They're leaving right from school, Michael said. He said the car would be all right in the school parking lot. I could hear it in his voice again, his knowledge of the lie. After what had happened last fall, Arnie would no more leave Christine in a public parking lot than he would show up in calc class naked. Uh-huh, I said. But if you should happen to look out the window and see her in the driveway anyhow, stay clear. Do you understand? Yes, but call my father first. Promise me. All right, I promise. But Dennis... Thank you, Michael. I hung up. My hands and feet were numb with the cold, but my forehead was slick with sweat. I pushed the door of the phone booth open with the tip of one crutch and worked my way back to Petunia. What did he say? Lee asked. Did he promise? Yes, I said. He promised, and my dad will see that they get together. I'm pretty sure of that. If Christine goes for anyone tonight, it will have to be us.
All right, she said. Good.
I threw Petunia into gear, and we rumbled away. The stage was set, as well as I could set it anyway. And now there was really nothing to do but wait and see what would come. We drove across town to Darnell's garage through steady, light snow, and I pulled into the parking lot at just past 1 that afternoon. The long, rambling building with its corrugated steel sides was totally deserted, and Petunia's belly-high wheels cut through deep, unplowed snow to stop in front of the main door. The signs bolted to that door were the same as they had been on that long-ago August evening when Arnie first drove Christine there. Save money. Your know-how. Our tools. Garage space rented by the week, month, or year. And honk for entry. But the only one that really meant anything was the new one leaning in the darkened office window, closed until further notice. Sitting in one corner of the snowy front lot was an old crumpled Mustang, one of the real door suckers from the 60s. Now it sat silent and broody under a shroud of snow.
It's creepy, Lee said in a low voice.
Yeah, it sure is. I gave her the keys I'd made at the Western Auto that morning. One of these will do it. She took the keys, got out, and walked over to the door. I kept an eye in both rearview mirrors while she fumbled at the lock, but we didn't seem to be attracting any undue attention. I suppose there is a certain psychology involved in seeing such a big, conspicuous vehicle. It makes the idea of something clandestine or illegal harder to swallow. Lee suddenly tugged hard on the door, stood up, tugged again, and then came back to the truck. I got the key to turn, but I can't get the door up, she said. I think it's frozen to the ground or something. Great, I thought. Wonderful. None of this was going to come easily.
Dennis, I'm sorry, she said, seeing it on my face.
No, it's all right, I said. I opened the driver's door and performed another of my comical sliding exits.
Be careful, she said anxiously, walking beside me with her arm around my waist as I crutched carefully through the snow to the door. Remember your leg.
Yes, Mother, I said, grinning a little. I stood in profile to the door when I got there so I could bend down to the right and keep my weight off my bad leg. Bent over in the snow, left leg in the air, left hand holding onto my crutches, right hand grasping the roll-up door's handle. I must have looked like a circus contortionist. I pulled and felt the door give a little, but not quite enough. She was right. It had iced up pretty good along the bottom. You could hear it crackling. Grab on and help me, I said. Lee placed both of her hands over my right hand, and we pulled together. That crackling sound became a little louder, but still the ice wouldn't quite give up its grip on the foot of the door. We've almost got it, I said. My right leg was throbbing unpleasantly, and sweat was running down my cheeks. I'll count. On 3, give it all you've got, okay?
Yes, she said.
1, 2, 3. What happened was the door came free of the ice all at once, with absurd deadly ease. It flew upward on its tracks, and I stumbled backward, my crutches flying. My left leg folded underneath me, and I landed on it. The deep snow cushioned the fall somewhat, but I still felt the pain in a kind of silver bolt that seemed to ram upward from my thigh all the way to my temples and back down again. I clenched my teeth over a scream, barely keeping it in, and then Lee was on her knees in the snow beside me, her arm around my shoulders.
Dennis, are you all right?
Help me up. She had to do most of the pulling, and both of us were gasping like winded runners by the time I was on my feet again with my crutches propped under me. Now I really needed them. My left leg was in agony.
Dennis, you won't be able to work the clutch in that truck now.
Yeah, I will. Help me back, Lee. You're as white as a ghost. I think we ought to get you to a doctor. No, help me back.
Dennis, Lee, help me back.
We inched our way back to Petunia through the snow, leaving shuffling, troubled tracks in the snow behind us. I reached up, laid hold of the steering wheel, and did a chin-up to get in, scraping feebly at the running board with my right leg. And still, in the end, Lee had to get behind me and put both hands on my keister and shove. At last, I was behind Petunia's wheel, hot and shivering with pain. My shirt was wet with snowmelt and sweat. Until that day in January of 1979, I don't think I knew how much pain can make you sweat. I tried to jam down the clutch with my left foot, and that silver bolt of pain came again, making me throw my head back and grind my teeth until it subsided a little.
Dennis, I'm going down the street and find a phone and call a doctor. Her face was white and scared. You broke it again, didn't you, when you fell?
I don't know, I said. But you can't do that, Lee. It'll be your folks or mine if we don't end it now. You know that.
LeBay won't stop. He has a well-developed sense of vengeance. We can't stop.
But you can't drive it, she wailed.
She looked up into the cab at me, crying now. The hood of her parka had fallen back in our mutual struggle to get me up into the driver's seat, where I now sat in magnificent uselessness. I could see a scatter of snowflakes in her dark blonde hair. Go inside there, I said. See if you can find a broom or a long stick of wood.
What good will that do? She asked, crying harder. Just get it, and then we'll see.
She went into the dark maw of the open door and disappeared from view. I held onto my leg and sparred with terror. If I really had broken my leg again, there was a good chance I'd be wearing a built-up heel on my left foot for the rest of my life. But there might not even be that much of my life left if we couldn't put a stop to Christine. Now, there was a cheery thought. Lee came back with a push broom. Will this do? She asked. To get us inside, yes. Then we'll have to see if we can find something better. The handle was the type that unscrews. I got hold of it, unthreaded it, and tossed the bristle end aside. Holding it in my left hand along my side, just another goddamn crutch, I pushed down the clutch with it. It held for a moment, then slipped off. The clutch sprang back up. The top of the handle almost bashed me in the mouth. Looking good, Gilder. But it would have to do. Come on, get in, I said. Dennis, are you sure?
As sure as I can be, I said.
She looked at me for a moment and then nodded.
Okay.
She went around to the passenger side and got in. I slammed my own door, depressed Petunia's clutch with the broom handle, and geared into first. I had the clutch halfway out, and Petunia was just starting to roll forward when the broom handle slipped off the clutch again. The septic tanker ran inside Darnell's garage with a series of neck-snapping jerks, and when I slammed my right foot down on the brake, the truck stalled. We were mostly inside. Lee, I've got to have something with a wider foot, I said. This broom handle don't cut it. I'll see what there is. She got out and began to walk around the edge of the garage floor, hunting. I stared around. Creepy, Lee had said, and she was right. The only cars left were four or five old soldiers so gravely wounded that no one had cared enough to claim them. All the rest of the slant spaces, with their numbers stenciled in white paint, were empty. A few baldies remained, heeled over against one another like giant donuts blackened in the fire, but that was all. One of the two lifts was partially up, with a wheel rim caught beneath it. The front-end alignment chart on the right-hand wall glimmered faintly red and white, the two headlight targets like bloodshot eyes, and shadows, shadows everywhere. Overhead, big box-shaped heaters pointed their louvers this way and that, roosting up there like weird bats. It seemed very much like a death place.
Lee had used another of Jimmy's keys to open Will's office. I could see her moving back and forth in there through the window Will had used to look out at his customers. Those working Joes who had to keep their cars running so they could blah, blah, blah. She flipped some switches, and the overhead fluorescence came on in snow-cold ranks. So the electric company hadn't cut off the juice. I'd have to have her turn the lights
off again. We couldn't afford to risk attracting attention. But at least we could have some heat. She opened another door and disappeared temporarily from view. I glanced at my watch. 1:30 now. End of side 12. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.